With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Sporticos Football Stories podcast. My name is Craig Hansen and today I'm joined by Tom Mallows, a freelance sports journalist and lifelong Everton fan. Tom was a co-founder of Royal Blue Mersey, a Toffees blog on the SB Nation network over a decade ago, where he still writes today. Tom's work can also be seen across the football landscape, including in places like the BBC. He's seen it all over the years, the ups, the downs, and I can't wait to hear about his experiences today as an Everton fan on the Sporticos Football Stories podcast. Don't forget, if you enjoy the show, we urge you to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. This is extremely important to us. We thank you so much in advance for helping our little podcast to grow. Hey Tom, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, not so bad. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom. I can't wait to get into all things Everton with you. Before we get to the stuff on the pitch right now with Rafa and with the recent performances, I want to take a little trip down memory lane, and I wondered if you could tell myself and the listeners sort of when and how you became an Everton fan.
Sure. Well, they say Evertonians are born, not manufactured, and I think it was the case with me. My mum and all her family are from Liverpool, and they're all big Evertonians. And that was just passed down the generations. My older brother and older sister were Blues, as were my older cousins. So I wasn't really given much of a choice. I don't remember consciously choosing to support Everton, but I don't remember consciously choosing anyone else either. And I think, you know, had I decided to support anyone else, especially that red lot across the park, I probably would have been cast out of the family. So it was just one of those where, yeah, it was Everton or nothing. And it's been like that ever since.
Oh, yeah. A lot of lonely Christmases if you would have done that.
Yeah, I would have been in the bottom of the garden. Yeah.
So where did you grow up then, Tom? Because that's what I thought when I first spoke to you. You don't sound like a Scouser.
No, I grew up not too far. It's a place called Ormskirk, which is just north of Liverpool in West Lancashire. But it's only about, if you can get the train, it's only about 25 minutes to Goodison. So growing up, I had sort of easy access to get to the game, so I was able to go regularly. I haven't got the accent. So my mum moved away from Liverpool when she went to university and lost her accent slightly, so I didn't quite pick it up when I was growing up.
Yeah, I know that exact feeling, because I'm from a place called Warsaw in the Black Country. I don't know if you know it. We're in the fourth tier.
Mm-hmm.
As you can probably tell, I've lost my accent as well from when I went to uni and then sort of living away for years and years. And now I don't have a big Black Country accent anymore. So that's why I wondered when I heard yours. I thought, I was expecting, like, you know, Jamie Carragher or something.
Yeah. No, a lot of people always tell me that. I'm one of those people, whoever I'm with for a certain length of time, I end up sort of mimicking their accent. So I've sort of got a mishmash of different people's accents I've been around over the years. And I've lost any Scouse twang that I did have growing up.
And with Ormskirk being quite close, to the city, what's the football culture like there? I mean, have they got their own like non-league team that maybe I haven't heard of, or do people tend to follow Liverpool, Everton, any other? When you were at school, who were the big teams that everyone was supporting?
Oh, it was definitely Everton and Liverpool. Yeah, you had a lot of people from Liverpool moved out to live in Ormskirk. So it was really, they were the dominant ones, Everton and Liverpool. We had the odd Manchester United, not as much Man City in those days, but it was Everton or Liverpool. And so growing up, yeah, there was that rivalry. You know, I had friends who were Evertonians. There was a group of us, and then a large group of Liverpool fans. There seemed to be more of them typically, but yeah, it was you know, we were football mad. It was just an offshoot of Liverpool, really. There was, you know, there's a lot of football fans and a lot of Everton and Liverpool fans particularly.
And how did you feel about that rivalry? Because I know that it's very intense there in the city. Being a little tiny bit separated from it, was it still just as intense, the sort of rivalry in the school with like that split that you sort of talked about? Or was it a little bit different being a little bit separated from it?
It felt just as intense. I don't know whether maybe one, you know, schools in the middle of Liverpool would beg to differ, but it certainly felt that way. Yeah, you know, there was that real sort of passion, and because we were reasonably close, you know, people were going to the games regularly as well. So, there was definitely that rivalry growing up and in school, and you know, derby days. You know, luckily, sort of growing up, Everton actually had a half decent record in derbies, so you know, going into school the next day was actually good fun. You could have a bit of banter with everyone. So yeah, no, it felt just as intense than it would be in central Liverpool, as it might not be sort of elsewhere. So yeah, you definitely had that rivalry growing up, and certainly, yeah, there's some, you know, our school friends, you know, we're mates, but also, yeah, we were rivals as well when it came to football.
And how do you feel about it now? Do you still feel quite passionate about the derby now, or when you get older, they sort of mellowed out a little bit?
a bit.
I know I have.
Yeah, it's a bit of both, really, because Everton's record has been pretty atrocious recently, and you sort of learn to accept the defeats a little bit more. I think that's, you know, the sort of polite way of saying it. You know, supporting someone like Everton who haven't been great, you know, if you got yourself worked up every time they lost a game or they lost a derby, then you know, you'd go mad, because it happens quite often. So you learn to accept the defeat. But then on the day, you know, you do, you know, that's, you're still as excited and have that anticipation. You know, when we beat them at Anfield in February for the first time in over 20 years, you know, I was jumping up and down, running around my living room, just as I would have been, you know, all those years ago. So you do chill out, because you just put things a little bit more perspective, you know, and real life takes over. You've got more important things to worry about. But in that moment, at that time, it's the most important thing that matters at that moment. So you're just as passionate. It's maybe sort of afterwards, you know, I might, if you lose, I'll have an hour or so to grumble, and then there'll be, you know, real life will hit again, and I'll move on and get over it quite quickly.
What's your favourite derby memory? So, I mean, it could be that one that you just mentioned, but do you remember any others from when you were a kid as well? I think you said that they were doing quite well in the derbies back then. Do you have any particular goals that you remember, or particular moments that you really loved?
So I grew up in the 90s. So the first ever derby game I went to, and I think it was one of the first ever games I'd gone to, was back in 1994. And Everton were bottom of the league at that point. They had won one game all season. And it was Joe Royle's first game as manager. Mike Walker had been sacked a couple of weeks ago. And we won 2-0. I think Liverpool were doing really well. They were maybe second or third at that point. And Duncan Ferguson scored his first goal for Everton in the Gladys Street end, which is where I was. And it was a Monday night, sort of November time as well. So it's one of those cold winter's nights. It's a fantastic atmosphere. And I just remember just absolutely loving the atmosphere. You know, I'd just started going to the games at that point, and I was sort of hooked from then onwards. And that still goes down as one of my favourite derby games. Another one probably will be that the last win at Anfield in 1999. I went as well. I was actually sat with Liverpool fans when Kevin Campbell scored fairly early on, and we held on to win 1-0. And what the great thing was is I remember jumping up and celebrating when Campbell scored. And you know, there's certain derby matches you can't really get away with that. You know, you get hooked out quite quickly. But I know they talk about, they say, you know, the cliche is with Everton Liverpool, it's the friendly derby. I wouldn't go that far, but certainly, you know, if you know, an Everton fan of Liverpool and you jump up and celebrate, you're not going to get, most of the time, you're not getting into trouble unless you start really mouthing off and winding up the fans deliberately. There's a sort of, there's tolerance level there. There's an acceptance that, you know, there's going to be, when I've been at Goodison, there's been loads of Liverpool fans in the Everton then jumping up and down when they scored. And that's part of the atmosphere. So as long as you don't push it too far, it is generally tolerated. And I remember jumping up and down when Campbell scored. It was after about 5 or 6 minutes. And then we were just hanging on for the rest of the game. So I was there sat on my hands for about 85 minutes. And that was, you know, brilliant moment. I didn't think at the time it would be over 20 years before we'd win there again. So that's why it's pretty special to me. So there were two of my earlier memories. And we've not had that many since. I suppose one of the later ones was an FA Cup replay in 2009, which went to extra time. And in the last minute of extra time, Dan Gosling scored right in the last minute at Goodison to send us through. And that was a good moment as well. But you know, there've been few and far between since. So when they do happen, you make sure that you make the most of them.
And I think I read during my research that Big Dunk is your favourite player, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Is that, do you think that first, seeing him score that first goal, would that have been a big part of the reason for that? Or what was it about him that sort of captured your imagination when you were a kid?
Yeah, that was definitely, it was a moment because he joined on loan from Rangers a couple of months before then. And he said subsequently that he wasn't that fussed. He was planning on going back to Rangers afterwards. You know, it was just a chance to play a bit of regular football. But he fell in love with the club, joined that loan spell. And the fans fell in love with him as well. You know, that derby goal, you score a goal against Liverpool and, you know, you're going to be pretty well set with the fans. And he scored some fantastic goals that season, you know, and it was also the year we ended up winning the FA Cup. So, you know, he'd go down as, you know, part of the team that last won a trophy. But it was just that connection he had with the supporters, that passion and energy that he had. He had the edge to him as well, you know. Got sent off more than a few times, but that's part of why we loved him as well. And he's kept that connection now. And when you're growing up, and we had some pretty bad teams in the 90s, the very least you want someone to show that passion and fight for the shirt. And that's what he had. And he had that connection with the fans. And players who have that connection with the supporters, they don't come along that often. And he's still got it now. If you remember a couple of years ago, he was caretaker manager for a few games when Marcus Silva was sacked, and he was dancing down the touchline and hugging ball boys and jumping.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't get that very often. So, yeah, he was just growing up. And I think whatever age you are, when you first start going to the matches, those players who were there at that age, they will always be pretty special. And that's the case. I think if you ask anyone of my age or anyone who grew up watching Everton in the 90s, Duncan Ferguson will be up there. And yeah, he still is now. He's my absolute hero now. You know, I'm sure I'd, if I saw him in the street, I'd be in awe of him now. Because he was a great player growing up, and he's still got that connection with the club now.
Yeah, isn't he still there under Rafa?
Yeah,
now,
he's still coached. He's been through a few managers. They don't seem to got rid of him just yet, but
I think they're too scared to tell him they don't want him to be in the backroom staff.
Who's going to tell him, you know? I don't know if you remember the story of when some burglars tried to break into his house, and
I think I did, maybe, can you remind me?
Yes, so I think there was a couple of them tried to break into his house, and you know, big mistake, and he ended up tackling one of them and sitting on them while the police arrived. And I think, yeah, so they've regretted it ever since. So I think he may have hurt his arm in the scuffle as well. So they can't have done their research correctly, the would-be burglars, because I can only imagine their face when they tried to break into the house and then Duncan Ferguson was in front of them. I think they immediately regretted that decision. So, and again, that just adds to his, you know, his story, his mystique, and why everybody loves him so much, because, yeah, you don't want to get on the wrong side of him. But at the same time, he's a big softy as well. Like, you know, he does a lot of he does a lot for the community, and you know, sends a lot of video messages to fans and stuff. So yeah, he's a bit of an enigma really, because he's got that sort of reputation of being a hard man, but also at the same time he's got that soft side as well.
And he's a real part of the fabric of the club now in the city, isn't he? So that's,
yeah,
it's a great story to hear. But you mentioned there that sort of when you're in the doldrums a little bit, the least that you ask for is just a bit of graft. And I wondered about, I wanted to get your insight into what the fans sort of expect, because it seems like every club, they have a different kind of, the fans have their own philosophy and they have their own sort of demands. Like, I watched this this video about the Boca Juniors and River Plate rivalry the other day. Mm-hmm. And the guys on there were talking that the Boca fans were saying that we don't care about playing good football. We just want, if the players give everything 100%, then we're happy. And then the River fans were like, we want to play silky football and we don't care if we win as long as the football's good. What do you think the Everton philosophy is as a fan? Are you more that fan watching, going, look, if you give 100%, if I can tell that you've run your legs off, then you're fine with me? Or are you the one watching going, no, we want a bit of flair and quality? What kind of, where do Everton fans go on that sort of spectrum, do you think?
I think definitely leaning towards, you know, they're giving the 100%, working hard. You know, Evertonians want, they want to see good football. You know, they were famously known as the School of Science in sort of in the mid part of last century, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you know, because they played this great brand of football. But at the same time, they want to see passion for the shirt. They want to play quick, intense, moving the ball forward quickly. And they will accept players' limitations as long as they're giving them all for the shirt. You know, if the players maybe who had more individual talent, if they're not seen to be giving everything, if they're shirking out of tackles, or they're not really running, or they're giving up, they won't be given as much leeway as players who maybe aren't as naturally talented, but they will be seen to give everything for the shirt. And you see that Goodison, the atmosphere at Goodison at its best is when the crowd are really on top of the players. And the players are responding, they're flying into tackles, they're pushing forward, you know, real fast, intense football. And that's sort of the minimum they ask, really. So, yeah, there probably is some similarities with Boca,
maybe, yeah, with the Boca, yeah, Boca fans. Yeah.
You know, Boca, because obviously with Liverpool as well, because of their success they've had, they're a bit more of a global club. They have more global fans coming in, so it's a slightly different crowd there. Everton tend to be a more local crowd. You know, David Moyes' famous phrase, you know, the people's club. You sense that, you know, at Goodison. So, yeah, if you ask any player who signs for Everton, you give your all, and you know, Evertonians will forgive you for mistakes or not being quite up to a certain level, because there is a minimum there, and that's giving everything for the shirt and working hard.
Yeah, I think I feel the same. That's sort of my philosophy on it as well. If I go to a game, I like to see the players working hard, running, pressing.
Yep.
If you're lazy, I can't abide that. And also being brave, like you said, in terms of getting the ball forward. It doesn't matter if you lose the ball, but you just try and do something good. Try and get the ball forward. Try and progress. Then I'll give you a lot of leeway, sort of thing, as a fan.
Yep.
But if you just, you know, if you're just waltzing around, not putting in any effort, then I can't really stand that. But every club and every fan has their different philosophies. That's what's so interesting about it. But we spoke a little bit about the atmosphere then at the Goodison. Can you tell me a little bit about this Bramley Moor Dock project? Because I've got to be honest, obviously, as a non-Everton fan, I don't really know much about it. I just know that they're building a new stadium. Can you tell us about that? When's it going to happen? Where's it going to be? What's the sort of reaction?
Sure, yeah. So the building work just started. So, and I think it's a 3-year build. So the plan is to be in, I think, the start of the 2023-24 season. I think the best way is to go right back to the beginning. And the Everton have been trying to move stadiums for over 20 years, really. Going back to sort of the mid-90s, there was an acceptance that Goodison perhaps wasn't right for redevelopment. It was controversial at the time because supporters felt that there wasn't really enough effort done to really investigate whether Goodison could be redeveloped, because moving away from such an old historic stadium is a really big big moment, and it's part of the club's identity, and it's not something you want to give up lightly. But as time progressed, it did become apparent that it was too landlocked. It's complete on three sides. It's completely locked by dense terraced housing, so you just isn't the space to build. You can't go any higher either because of, you know, regulations, right to light regulations now. So, and it would take too long to redevelop piece by piece. You know, it would just be too expensive. So there was growing acceptance that we had to move. Now there was a chance to move to the docks initially, a place called King's Dock in the early 2000s. But Everton had to pull out because they didn't have the money, and it's where now the Liverpool Arena is. That's on that plot. And then there was a controversial move in 2007 to move out to Kirby, which is outside the city limits. So there was a huge protest against that because it felt as though it was out of sight, out of mind. It was taking Everton out of the city of Liverpool. It was going to be sort of one of these sort of identikit stadiums on a retail park next to a Tesco. It just didn't seem to be the right move, and that collapsed. And then for a long time, we were struggling to find an alternative site. And then when Farhad Moshiri took over in 2016, his immediate priority was to find a site for a new ground. And this land at Bramley Moor Dock came up. It's a little bit further down from where King's Dock is and where the Albert Dock and a lot of the tourist attractions are. And it's been disused for a long time. The dock, the water's still there, but the chance to move, I think for the Evertonians, if they're going to leave Goodison Park, there's only a few places they'd want to move. And one of those is to the docks, which is, you know, intrinsically linked with the history of the city. You know, its growth as a global city was linked with the docks. So, yeah, and, you know, the chance to form part of the waterfront and the skyline, you know, it's too big an opportunity to turn down. It's taken a long time because we've had so many failed moves. They've tried to make everything, every step is done meticulously. And it's going to take a lot of work because at the moment they're draining the dock. They're infilling it with sand. You know, there's a lot of preparatory work before they can even start actually building the thing. So they're doing that at the moment. The proper building work will start next year. And I think it'll be 48,000 or maybe 45,000. So it's going to be, yeah, and the plans look fantastic. You know,
yeah, I saw a picture on Google. It does look amazing.
Yeah.
It looks like it's going to be really cool.
Yeah, it does. It's going to be unique. You know, they worked really hard with the supporters. The designer is an American guy called Dan Meese, and he came across to Liverpool and held workshops with the supporters to really get an idea of what they wanted from the new ground. And part of it was trying to take as much of the atmosphere as Goodison as possible. You're not going to have everything, because part of why Goodison is what it is because it's an older ground. It's tight, it's cramped, it's right on top. You know, to have more comfortable seats, and you're going to have things a little bit bigger. But, you know, they've worked really hard to try and get, you know, some of the designs of Goodison in the new ground. And it will be an absolute game changer for Everton, if you know, once they move there, because it doesn't matter how far we progress on the pitch, which we aren't doing at the moment, but there's always going to be that ceiling, because as much as I love Goodison, it's too old and it's not got the facilities for modern football anymore. So if we are going to progress and fulfil the ambitions that we want, which is, you know, a team that's qualifying for Europe regularly and winning trophies, you need to be in a bigger ground that can help generate that extra revenue. So it really is. It could be a real turning point for Everton. And, you know, it's going to be a really sad day when we leave Goodison. And if you've not been, I'd really urge you to go to at least once, just to experience it. It's not the most comfortable, you know, there's cramped wooden seats and the views on it, but, you know, the atmosphere there isn't that many stadiums like it, certainly not in the Premier League. So yeah, it'll be a really sad day when we leave Goodison, but at the same time when we, you know, run out on our new stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey, yeah, that'll be a special day as well, and a real, I think, turning point for the club.
I'll have to try and get down there while I still can, because there's a few grounds like that I never went to. I definitely never went to Highbury, because that went when I was only a teenager, and then the Bulling ground went a few years ago, didn't it? So I'll have to try and get up there.
Yeah,
I don't know who. Maybe I could. I've got a few friends who are Aston Villa fans. because they're obviously from being around here, so maybe we could try and get an away day going. But to go from the future back to the past a little bit, I wanted to talk about some of the great managers during our lifetime, and I guess where better to start than Walter Smith and his tragic passing in last week, I think it was. I just wondered if you could say a few words about sort of the impact that he had when you were watching, and how would you sort of sum him up as a manager and a man?
Yeah, I've actually been thinking that quite a lot, say, since the news of his passing, thinking about the years he was in charge of Everton. And it won't go down as, you know, the one of the best periods in Everton's history, but it was eventful, and it was still a really difficult time. He took charge in the summer of 1998, and the previous season we just stayed up on goal difference in the Premier League. So it wasn't, you know, we didn't have the greatest of teams. He was given some money to spend, but then later that year, it turns out the money he had spent was the banks, and the banks wanted some of it back. So the then chairman, Peter Johnson, infamously sold Duncan Ferguson behind Walter Smith's back in order to appease the banks. And, you know, Walter Smith was left furious with that, and understandably so. So that summed up his tenure, really. He was constantly trying to build teams, but then he'd had to sell players at the same time, so he could never really have any consistency. The football wasn't great at times, so there was a time sort of at the end of the 1998-99 season and the 1999-2000 season, he bought Kevin Campbell on loan, and he scored a heap of goals to keep us up at the end of that season. And he played up front with Francis Jeffers, who just emerged from the academy, and things seemed to click. And we had Don Hutchison, John Collins, Nick Barmby in midfield. Things really looked promising, and we had a decent season that year. But then in the summer, again, he had to sell. Hutchison left, John Collins left, but Nick Barmby famously crossed the park to Liverpool. So he was constantly sort of chasing his tail, trying to rebuild. And it was a difficult time. And I think when he did leave in March of 2002, it probably was the right decision, because we looked to be sliding down the table. But even then, there was never, you know, the fans never truly turned on Smith. I think there was never really, from what I recall, a chance for him to go or any real anger, because I think there was an understanding that of the difficulties that he had to deal with. He had one hand tied behind his back, even though it probably was the right decision for him to leave at that time. And he was just a very dignified, honourable man. You know, he represented the club well, and with a sort of a quiet dignity. And he was through a very difficult period for the club. He'll always obviously be remembered more for his time at Rangers because of the success he had for two spells. But I think he will be remembered fondly by Everton fans for what was, you know, a difficult time for the club. But he kept us going, and he served the club well. And he certainly never disrespected the club. And I think he had kind words to say once he'd left us as well. And there's reports that once he'd been told he'd been sacked, he then sat with Chairman Bill Kenwright and helped them pick the successor. And he played a role in recommending David Moyes to come and succeed him. And we all know what David Moyes did in those years afterwards. So, yeah, he just comes across as a really decent guy. Obviously, very sad news of his passing last week.
That's a perfect segue into David Moyes. I've got two questions for you on Moyes. I mean, first of all, how well remembered is he? I'd like to think amazingly so, because during sort of my era of watching football, I think that's one of the best, like, extended periods of time a manager's had at a club of, like, I would say continued success, pretty much. But I wondered how well is he remembered by fans, and also how do Everton fans react to him sort of, you know, rising from the ashes with West Ham? Because as a neutral with sort of no skin in the game, like, I'm really happy to see him, you know, after he went to Man United, you know, and that sometimes nowadays that's just sort of a place where careers die, isn't it? Like, manager or player, just go in there is poison chalice. And then he had his time at Sociedad and I think Sunderland and his first spell at West Ham. And it looked like he was, you know, really on that slide. Like, it looked like he was headed for championship level soon. And now look at what he's doing at West Ham. I mean, as a neutral, I think it's hard not to feel happy for him when you see him jumping up and down on the sideline smiling. As an Everton fan, do you have the same sensation?
I do, yes. I don't know if all the Evertonians can say that way, but I'm really glad to see he's got got back to his, something like his best, because I always thought he was a great manager. Dread to think where Everton would be without David Moyes, because he managed to turn them from a team that spent previous sort of 5-10 years before he arrived scrabbling to stay in the league to a team that was regularly in the top 6-7, qualifying for Europe, but all the time hardly spending any money. You know, with Everton was so skint during that time, he was really having to scrimp and save, and it did cost us a few times, because I just felt if we had a little bit extra cash at certain moments, we really could have pushed on. You know, we got to that glass ceiling trying to get fourth place. He did an absolutely fantastic job, and Everton fans understood when Manchester United came calling. We always knew that Sir Alex Ferguson was a fan, and thought that when he did go, that Moyes would be up there as one of the candidates to replace him. What left Everton fans frustrated was the way he behaved in the first few months as Manchester United manager. He seemed to talk down to Everton, and he tried to sign Leighton Baines and Marouane Fellaini over the summer and made some ridiculously low bids, and basically inferred that, you know, Everton should just let them go for the good of their career, and so, sort of things that, had another manager said that to him when he was Everton manager, he would have really railed against that. And he did end up signing Fellaini, but Baines stayed. So that did sour the relationship for a few years. But as time went on,
I can understand that. That is a bit annoying.
It felt as though we'd given this huge reception when he'd left on his final game. And it felt as though, you know, he'd suddenly... But I'd be interested to see what he said, because I do think those first few months of the job, he conceded, definitely made mistakes. And I think the way he approached certain things, he probably thinks he could have done differently. And I certainly think that is one of those. But as time's gone on, I think things have softened. And I think we've looked at certainly how the team struggled with money in the past 5 or 6 years and realised what a good job he did. There was probably time for him to go because maybe things had got a little bit stale. But certainly, he was linked with a return, actually, when Marcus Silva was sacked, and a big group of Evertonians were dead against it, didn't want him coming back. And you can understand why, because at that point he was, as you say, he'd struggled at all these clubs at Sociedad. And Sunderland, he just looked as though he was on his way down. So you can understand why the fans didn't want him back. But he's gone back to West Ham, and I'm really chuffed to see, because I always felt he was a great manager. And actually, he's applied the same template, really, he had at Everton at West Ham. You look at some of the players they've got, Suchek in midfield, he's very Marouane Fellaini-like. He's got the big striker up front. He had some decent strikes at Everton, Yakubu being one of them.
Using his full-backs in the same way, sort of good up-and-down full-backs.
Yeah, you sign from the Championship and you bring through, brilliant at set pieces, both attacking and defending.
Small squad as well. He likes to have a small group of players that sort of same team every week.
Yeah. Yeah, a real sort of close bond. You hear them speak, and the way they talk about that real sort of team spirit, that sort of us against them mentality. He's done a brilliant job. It just seems to have clicked. It's the right sort of club for him. Maybe Manchester United was just too big. But I think he's doing great things, and I think it'd be interesting to see whether he's got a bit of money to spend in January. Because what let him down a lot of times was he never had any money with Everton, so at times when maybe we could have done with an extra strike or just a few extra bodies in the January window, we didn't. And so we fell away and we missed out in the top four a few times. But if he's got a bit of cash to maybe strengthen the squad in January, I think he can do some great stuff at West Ham. Certainly, I think looking at the league this year, fourth place is up for grabs. It's whether, as you say, he likes that small squad, whether they can maintain it throughout the season. So that's where I think if he can bring some more players in January, he'll do a good job. So, yeah, there's sort of what might have been, had he come back for that second spell. But I think it was the right decision. And I'm just glad that he is doing well, because I always thought he was a good manager. And as time goes on, I think most Evertonians will look back at his time with fondness and recognise just what he did for the club, because we had no money. And if you drop out the Premier League at that point and you can't afford to get back up, then you could be stuck down there for a long, long time. Look at a club like Leeds, or even teams like Sheffield Wednesday being down there for a long time. Sunderland dropped down to League One. Yeah, Forest, they've been down for 20-odd years. So you drop out It's very hard to come back. So, he did a fantastic job with very little resources.
Well, to go from two managers who will probably go down in the sort of, you know, in the good books, to two that are maybe a little bit more controversial. I want to come on to Carlo Ancelotti first, but before we do that, we're going to take one very quick break. And we're back. So, Tom, how surprised were you, first of all, when Carlo Ancelotti departed? And how annoyed were you by how it happened?
Very surprised and very annoyed. Because it seemed to come out of nowhere, really. You know, he talked so much about how much he enjoyed being part of a long-term project and how he was settled in the area and how he wanted to really, having moved across lots of super clubs for 2-3 years at a time, wanted to put down some roots and seem really committed. And then all of a sudden, the whole deal was done within the space of 2 or 3 days and he was off. So that was really, really disappointing because obviously it was a real coup for Everton to get someone like Carlo Ancelotti in the first place. And we felt as though that he really bought into it. You know, he seemed to really embrace the challenge and seemed to be ready, and Evertonians, you know, embraced him as well and were really excited. So they felt really let down, and I think understandably so. And I think the board have a right to feel let down as well, because they backed him as much as he could in the transfer market. He signed the players that he wanted to. You know, the transfer policy at the club supposedly is to bring in young players, but they allowed him to bring in the players he wanted, you know, James Rodriguez and Alan in particular. So, yeah, it just felt really, really let down. And interestingly, I actually read his book, Quiet Leadership, while he was Everton manager. And it was a bit revealing because he's a very good man manager. And that not just applies to players, it applies to, you know, executives. He's had to deal with some fairly feisty owners and chairmen over the years. And I think it applies to the fans as well. And I get the impression that a lot of the stuff he was saying to the fans was what we wanted to hear, because he knew that if you have the fans on the side, then your life as a manager is easier as well. And I'm not convinced whether he was exactly completely truthful with.
Yeah. He's a good politician, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a very good. He's a very good politician. He knows how to deal with everyone, know the right things to say and dealing with people. But also there has to be a bit of realism as well. You know, Real Madrid, Everton.
Yeah.
You know, we can't, you know, if Real Madrid come calling, he has got an affinity with the club and he maybe felt there was some unfinished business there. So you can't really be too annoyed. You have to accept that, you know, he's not a lifelong Evertonian like us. You know, when Real Madrid come calling, you know, pretty much 99% of people would jump at that chance. So it's really disappointing, and we just have to accept it. And it just, yeah, left a sour taste because, you know, we felt that, you know, he was really here for the long term and could have really done something.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, like you said, you have to understand it, sort of take yourself out of it. But it is nonetheless annoying, and as an Everton fan, it must have been very annoying. But was it when the fans were already sort of a little bit peeved about that whole situation, and then you hear the news that Rafa Benitez is the new manager? I mean, what was your initial reaction to that?
When the rumours first started, I just thought there's no way the club would do it.
No way.
Just because there's being a former Liverpool manager, and there's also being a former Liverpool manager who openly looked to goad Evertonians and wind the opposition up. And, you know, he had his history where he referred to us as a small club. And it was just, you know, what are they thinking? And it was the reaction I was worried with. I wasn't totally against it. You know, I could understand the logic behind it because he is a good coach. He's obviously wanted the job. He knows the area. He knows the club and what the fans want. And he was prepared to work. You know, we've been restricted with financial fair play over the summer, so we didn't have much money to spend, but he was willing to take that on. My fear is that there's a group of Evertonians who just won't have him, just won't accept it because of that Liverpool link. And as long as we're winning games and playing well, it's okay. But my fear is if things turn...
And they already have started to a little bit.
And they have started to. It could get fairly toxic fairly quickly, and then we'd be back to square one. And that is my fear. But having said that, and I've spoken to, you know, a few Liverpool fans who had, and a few Newcastle fans as well. And what they said, what Benitez does is, you know, when he's your manager, he will do everything to help your club, even if that includes, you know, winding up the opposition. So that's why when he was Liverpool manager, he was understandably having a pop at Everton, because that's what he wanted to do for the best at Liverpool. And he was doing that as Newcastle manager, and that's what he'll do for Everton as well. So that's all part of, he was just doing his job. And, you know, everything he's done and said so far, and he's spoken about the need for, we touched on earlier, I said about, you know, what Evertonians like, that sort of fast, committed style of play. He said that as well. He's lived on Merseyside or in the Northwest for a long time. So he knows Evertonians and he knows what they want, and he wants that style of football. And he's openly said, you know, how important it is to have the fans on side. So he is aware of it. And also he must be determined to take the job, because there's a lot of people who would not want to take that hassle on. So I think he's actually done a decent job given the circumstances. It's just, you know, we lost 3 in a bounce and it got a little bit tetchy. We were a little bit better against Tottenham last weekend. But if it gets goes a bit south over the winter, yeah, it could get a bit nasty again. But I've no complaints so far. You know, I think he's done a decent job given the circumstances. Now he's here, he needs to be given a chance, because he's not really had any money to spend. We can't keep chopping and changing managers. There's no obvious replacement if he does go. So we just need to give him a chance, accept this year as a transitional year, and then give him a summer, hopefully next year, where he can have a full summer with the players and hopefully bring some new signings in, and we'll see how we go next year.
And I think he spent pretty much no money on players that he bought pretty much to deliver, like you said, that style of play. So he brought in Damari Gray, Townsend, sort of fast, nippy wingers that he trusts. Mm-hmm. And like I said, he was going really, really well. I know form mm-hmm. dipped a little bit, but things move fast in football nowadays, don't they? All it takes is a few losses. Like I saw the Dean Smith thing at Villa, and I thought, that's crazy to me. Like, are they worried they're going down? I mean, just calm down. It's 11 games in. Like, they're gonna be fine. I think he could have got them to still maybe Europa League, even if they just relax. But, you know, it gets really toxic really quick, like you said. If Everton lose 2 or 3 games in a row more, then, you know, they're going to be calling for his head, aren't they? Especially because of the Liverpool link.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say it's the Merseyside derby at Goodison at the start of next month. And that will be interesting because, you know, if Liverpool come away with a big win, then, you know, there'll be, you know, the shouts, you know, shouts about Agent Benitez and all things like that. So that could be fun. But then again, you know, we beat them, and, you know, Benitez gets one over Liverpool, then, you know, Everton has suddenly warmed for him again. So yeah, that is a big game coming up. But as you say, yeah, he spent hardly any money. And also we've been really badly hit with injuries as well. You know, Calvert-Lewin's been out since August. Decore has been our best midfielder. He's been out for the past month with a broken foot. And Yeri Mina, our best defender, has been out for the past few weeks as well. So that's the entire spine of the side. So you take the best spine out of any team, you're going to struggle. When you've got a really small squad like Everton have as well, it's even worse. So he's been a little bit unlucky. I think get our best players back and, you know, we will have a decent team, particularly Calvert-Lewin, because that's Townsend and Gray coming in, wingers who can deliver the ball into the box. That's part of the reason why they brought them in. So he's hopefully not too far away from a return, and things hopefully will pick up then. It's just, yeah, say we've got a small squad and injuries. If they hit, then yeah, we're always going to struggle.
So to touch on the players then, away from the managers of the players, one player in particular, I wanted to ask about Tom Davies, because ever since he sort of came on the scene, I've always had high hopes for him, because you always like to see, as a neutral, I think, you know, the local lads playing for their local team, and I always sort of hope that they do well. Do you think he's reached his ceiling, or is there more to come from him? Can he get to a higher level? He's still only 23. What do you think's the future for him? Do you think he could he be a sort of one club man? Could he grow into being a really important player? I know it's not like he never plays now, but mm-hmm. it feels like he hasn't quite reached that potential that he has. What do you see in his future?
He's one of the players who is most talked about by Everton fans, because, as you say, yeah, we love to see academy players, particularly
because you must want him to succeed, right? The fans, I'm sure you want him to.
Desire to succeed. Sometimes it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes academy players are given more support, but also at the same time, there's greater expectation, and they often become the target of frustration as well. And Tom Davies, I have a degree of sympathy, because I think he's played on, I think it's 5 managers and 2 caretakers in 5 years. You know, when you're breaking into the team, that is very disruptive. Now you could point out, say, someone like Dominic Calvert-Lewin's the same, and how he's progressed. I also think Jonathan Rhys scored a brilliant goal against Manchester City. And he just burst through when he ran pretty much from the halfway line and finished off. And that almost became a bit of a curse because it raised expectations. And he just doesn't seem to have kicked on since then. The team has struggled as well, which doesn't help. And he does become the target sometimes, rightly or wrongly, of the fans' frustrations. I think the main issue is we're just not sure what type of midfielder he is. You know, is he a defensive midfielder? Is he box to box? Is he attacking? He doesn't seem to offer that much going forward. Doesn't score or assist that much, but he doesn't seem to be that sort of defensive N'Golo Kante type player either. So he's not really, he struggled to really find that place in the team. I have another degree of sympathy is sometimes he will look to play the ball forward. And you're talking before about how you don't want players playing it safe, but sometimes the players who try and be progressive and play the ball forward are more likely to give the ball away and then end up getting stick from the crowd. So it's a real tough one. I just think, as you say, at 23, he should be really kicking on now. He's experienced. He's made over 100 appearances, and I'm just not sure whether he's got enough to be a long-term fixture in the team, which is a shame because so you want their own, maybe a loan, maybe just chance to, maybe a bit of some new surroundings, playing week in, week out, try something different might benefit him. I remember Leon Osman, another player who came through the academy, he broke into the team fairly late as well, but he'd spent sort of 6 months on loan at Derby the previous season, did really well, and then he followed up that momentum and broke into the Everton team the following year. So maybe a loan would help. The problem is we've got such a small squad, we can't afford to let anyone go at the moment. But maybe next summer, look to loan him out and see. But see, 2024, it's fairly ruthless business football. And if you've not hit the standard expected by that point, I'm not sure. It's very rare these days for players to really push on after that age. So, he's one that does have a question mark over his future, which is a shame, as you say, because you love to see academy players come through and represent the team.
It is a shame, but as you said, it's sort of nowadays, you're washed up at 28, aren't you? So yeah. Time is of the essence.
It's ruthless. Yeah, it really is. and there's fans, again, rightly or wrongly, they judge a player and that's it, as you say. Yeah, and the businesses as well. There's such high stakes for managers. They can't afford to take risks on young players and give them their experience. If you don't, you get a few games, you don't cut it, the manager will take you out of the team because, as you say, look at Dean Smith, he's lost 5 games and now he's out. He's done a brilliant job. I know they struggled for form this calendar year, but that did seem very harsh to me. But that's the ruthless business that the Premier League is. So that there's, it's sink or swim.
It is. Ruthless for managers or players, but who would you say then is the most important player in the squad right now? Who is not even necessarily the fan favourite, but the person that just in the cold light of day you think we're really the first name on the team sheet, we really need this person to play?
Oh, that's a tough one.
It is, right? It is tough. Tough to only pick one. If you could pick a couple, maybe.
Probably a choice between two, it'd be between Richarlison and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, and I'd probably choose Richarlison just because he can play up front on his own and he can play either side. And while Calvert-Lewin finishes he scores the goals in the box, I think for his all-round play, Richarlison really can lift the team and bring it up a level in terms of performance. We really missed him the past couple of weeks. He's really competitive. He plays on the edge. He winds up opposition fans. He gets involved. He's just a really talented player, and he's been fantastic since he joined us. And I think there's an acceptance that he's not going to be around forever. Maybe even next summer, he might be one of those that's sold on for big money. But I'd say him not just because of his own ability and his versatility, but the fact that when he's in the team, he creates chances for us. He just drags the team up a level. But Calvert-Lewin's real close behind because you can have all the great approach play that you like, but if you haven't got someone to put the ball in the back of the net, then it's all for nothing. So he'd be really close as well, and he's another one of the reasons why we've struggled these past couple of weeks, because he's not been in the team.
So I guess given the up and down nature of the season then so far, there's been some, I thought an amazing start, thought Damari Gray was like a revelation. Andros Townsend, I couldn't believe that for like 2 million and a free, I think those two were. I was like, Benitez really is a genius. This is going so well. It's dropped off a little bit. It's a bit up and down. And there's been some issues, like you said, with injuries. What are your sort of expectations then for the season? What's sort of like a realistic goal that most Everton fans will be happy with?
I think we really have to lower our expectations this year. You know, the past few years, pushing for Europe had to be sort of a minimum, really. And we did that for much of last year. But given the change in manager, the small squad, the lack of money, we maybe have to temper that this year and accept that maybe mid-table, top 10 is what we can hope for, which is, you know, disappointing. And it seems very down to sort of lower your expectations like that. And it's not particularly exciting. Oh, we're just going to finish 10th this year, you know. But I just feel...
And it makes it less painful in the end, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, true. Exactly.
Every fan knows that.
Don't aim too high. You'll never be disappointed. But I just think we have to be patient because the financial issues... A few years ago, it was the summer of 2017 when Ronald Koeman was in charge. He spent about 200-odd million, and the majority of it was completely wasted. We ended up with a worse team. He was sacked. Sam Allardyce came in. We've been counting the cost of that ever since. You know, our owner wants to spend, but because we've made so many losses over the past few years but not had European football to compensate in terms of the extra income, we're completely hamstrung. So... You know, we spent 1.7 million in the summer, so we can't really have too high expectations. I think maybe the start we made perhaps got people a little bit excited, but I think the past few weeks is a bit more realistic of where we are. We're going to have an up and down year, depending on injuries. If we can push for, you know, top seven, then I think that would be, you know, a decent season. I don't think there's much between the sides, sort of below, obviously the top three, and then there's obviously someone like West Ham are doing really well. Man United are struggling. But I don't think there's much between, say, Arsenal, Tottenham, even Leicester and Everton. Maybe they have a bigger squad, but certainly on our day, with all players fit, we can compete with anyone. It's just the injuries that I think might cost us. If we get lucky and once these players come back and we have a season, you know, we're not in Europe, we're already out of the League Cup, so we won't have too many games. If we have our best team for most of the rest of the season, then, yeah, we have got a chance maybe sneaking a European place, but... I just think safely mid-table, top 10, maybe a cup run, and then we rebuild again next year, which sounds really boring. People are saying that, you know, that's not very ambitious and limiting it. But I think you also have to be realistic as well and take a long-term approach. We've had a few years where we've spent very recklessly and now we're paying the price. This is a chance to try and reset, get the finances in order while the stadium's being built. And then hopefully next summer, we can, you know, have a bit more targeted recruitment and find those key areas in the team and push on from there.
But it's good to be a realist because, like you said, you'll be less disappointed in the end that way. That's always my approach as well.
That's what supporting Everton's been like for the past 20 years. Say, like, you can't get too upset when they lose because it happens so often. You've got to have realistic expectations. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to cope, you know.
Well, Tom, to go from the players on the pitch right now to a few players from the past, we're going to do a little bit of trivia. But before we do that, we're going to take one very quick break. And we're back. So, Tom, at the end of every episode, we like to do a little thing called Do You Know Your Heroes? And we're going to have 8 questions for you here. They're a lot to do with sort of record holders, sort of numbers, dates, that kind of thing. But the most important thing is if you can give me the player in question, in those cases where it's a player or a year, you will get 1 point. Don't worry too much. Some of them are a bit ridiculous and sort of challenging, and some of the other ones I think are going to be pretty basic for you. But let's see how you get on. So question number one, having done so on 5 occasions, when did Everton last win the FA Cup?
Oh, that's a good one to start. 1995.
Correct. 1994-95. 1 point in the bag. Which player has made the most appearances for Everton in all competitions?
Neville Southall.
Correct. You have the point, but I don't suppose you want to have a guess at how many in all comps.
God.
It's a lot.
710.
Oh, very close. 751.
Ooh.
It's a ridiculous amount.
That is.
Between 1981 and 1998. On the other hand, though, which player has made the most European appearances in the club's history?
Oh.
This is a tough one. I have to say this one surprised me.
I'm going to say Leighton Baines.
Close, actually. Right era. It was Tim Howard.
Oh, of course.
Who made 28 between 2006 and 2016. That surprised me, actually, because I don't... Probably I'm just way off here, but because I don't... Obviously, I'm not an Everton fan, but I know that... didn't you have, was it in the 70s or 80s, this great era?
Yeah.
You know, when you were winning a lot of stuff. I just assumed there would have been some guys that I haven't heard of from the past who were playing in UEFA Cup every time or European Cup, but no, Tim Howard is the holder.
Well, one of the reasons was when Everton won the league a couple of times in the mid-80s, there was the European ban. So they were denied going to the European Cup twice. So that sort of held. So that was why, the numbers are limited. That really counted against them.
I should have remembered that because one of the first episodes we ever did was with a guy called Phil Roberts. He's from Across the Park.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on to talk Liverpool. And I asked him about the rivalry and why it's so intense. And one of his theories was that one of the several things is that, like you said, there was a time where you won the league, but you couldn't qualify for Europe because of the ban that sort of, not to blame Liverpool for that, but they were involved in the incident. It was the Heysel incident, right, that created that ban. So, that makes complete sense then. So, that explains probably why those guys of that era didn't get all those appearances. And in the end, it was the Moyes era, I think. Like you said, Baines, Howard, all those guys. But being the goalie, I suppose, makes sense.
Yeah.
Howard would have been on the sheet more often than not. So 2 out of 3. But which player remains the club's all-time top goal scorer in all competitions?
Surely it has to be Dixie Dean.
It is correct. Don't suppose you know how many? Doesn't matter, but just...
Ooh. I'm trying to think. Did he... 400?
Very close. 383.
Oh.
Between 1925 and 1937. So that's one of those ones where you're sort of like, that record has been hanging on in there for a long time. Is someone ever going to beat that? Who's the candidate? Could Calvert-Lewin be the guy to beat that?
He'd need to play for a long time to beat that, yeah. I think it would be a record that will stand pretty much. He also scored 60 league goals in one season as well, and that's a record that is unlikely to
be
broken.
I think that's borderline impossible to break. I mean... Maybe because it's all comps, like he could break this one if he played, like you said, and stayed all the way till he was about 38 or something and played all the cup games and stuff, he could break it. But 60 goals in one league season. I mean, that's never happening in the Premier League, is it? I don't think. Okay, question 5. Who is the club's record signing?
Gylfi Sigurdsson.
It is. I don't suppose you know how much.
Is it 45 million?
These ones were always disputed, but from my sources, it's 40 million.
40.
From Swansea City in 2017. But there's always variables with that. But you have the point nonetheless. 4 out of 5. Question 6. In 1986, which then Everton player came in second for the Ballon d'Or, losing out to the Ukrainian Igor Belanov? So 1986, Everton player finished second place in the Ballon d'Or, nearly won the Ballon d'Or that year.
Gary Lineker.
Very good. I thought this one would catch you out because he was only there for one season, wasn't he?
One year. Yeah, and then he went, I think it's to Barca. So
that's it, exactly. He was. He went to Barca after that.
I never knew he finished second in the Ballon d'Or that year.
It's understandable when you hear the stats. He scored 38 goals in 52 appearances in all competitions in that 85-86 season before. I mean, you can see why Barca came in for him.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And second place in the Ballon d'Or. And I have to be honest, I'd never heard of Igor Belanov, who actually won it. I think he played for Dynamo Kiev, were really big at the time. I love looking into those sort of stats because you see how different, you know, teams that you see in the Europa League and stuff now, how huge they were back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. 5 out of 6, Gary Lineker. Question 7. Who is the longest serving manager in the history of Everton Football Club?
Don't think it was Moyes. Oh, I've got to go Moyes, but I don't think it is.
Unlucky, that's what I thought. But, you know, I assumed it would be Moyes because he was there for a long... How long was he there, David Moyes?
13 years, I think.
It was a long time, but apparently Harry Catterick...
Oh, Catterick, yes.
...is the longest-serving manager in the history of the club. But it's got to be close. I mean, it could be a matter of days or months between them, so... Maybe Moyes could have stuck around a little bit longer. He would have had that record in the books.
Yeah.
But that puts us 5 out of 7. Question 8. This is one that we always do with everyone. Apart from England, which nationality is most represented in the current Everton first team squad, including players out on loan? So obviously the majority of players are from England. Who are the second most?
Oh. That's a good question.
Yeah, it always catches them out, this
one. Yeah. It can't be that many, either. I'm trying to think.
That's the thing. That's what makes it harder. Sometimes it's okay because you do a team where there's sort of like a big contingent like coming second. But Everton's like one of those teams where there's sort of England and then it's a lot of just little
twos
ones
and threes.
Or twos here, there, exactly.
Trying to go through the teams, and I think there's a couple of Brazilians, French, Irish in there.
Just to repeat, including players who are out on loan. Little tip for you there.
Ah, right.
I had to put that technicality in there because otherwise I couldn't separate the countries. Right. There's only one way of.
That could. Oh, I was thinking, yeah, because that could really. Because we've got so many different players on loan as well. Let me think. I'm going to go with French.
Correct. It is France with 3. Abdoulaye Doucouré, Lucas Digne, and Niels Nkunku is on loan at Standard Liège.
Yeah, of course.
I had to include that. Normally, I'd just sort of leave out the loan players if there's a clear winner, but because Brazil also have Alan and Richarlison.
Yeah.
The only way we could have a clear winner was to include the loan players, and Niels Nkunku is the wild card. And...
He's the type. That's a good
That's
question.
Why France have the most. So that gives you 6 out of 8. Very respectable score indeed. Especially because some of those were really... I'm surprised that you got the Lineker one. I thought I'd really got you with that one, especially with him being there for 1 year. I thought you'd be thinking of, I don't know, the 80s legends who were there for the whole period. But no. Anyway, Tom... So good to speak to you today. Before you go, could you tell the listeners where they can check out your writing or any other work you're doing, whether it's Royal Blue Mersey or otherwise?
Yeah, so I write for the Everton blog Royal Blue Mersey. So it's royalbluemersey.sbnation.com. I'm also a freelance journalist in my career as well. So you'll see me around off different places. I do a lot for BBC, so you might see me on BBC Football, BBC Cricket every now and then. But my name tends to pop up in different places. But yeah, certainly for the Everton content, check out Royal Blue Mersey. There's a good group of guys there. And we just following Everton. And yeah, say the site's been going for over 10 years now. It's been up and down, but we're always positive and you never know what's around the corner.
So Everton fans, check it out. Neutral football fans in general, check out Tom's content. And Tom, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure.
No problem. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much, buddy. Best of luck with the season. Hopefully you'll get back onto a good run soon and start getting up there towards those European places again.
Fingers crossed. Let's hope so. Cheers.
Thanks, buddy. Have a good one.
No problem. Cheers. Thanks a lot, Craig.
Thanks so much for listening to the Sportacos Football Stories podcast. Please like, share and leave 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. This is crucial to a show of our size. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, please tell a friend online or offline. That really helps a small podcast like ours to grow organically. Head to sportacos.com for live streams, data, statistics and much more from the world of football. You can also follow us on Twitter at sportacos.com. You can follow myself at Craig Sportacos. And we'd also love to read out the thoughts and questions of our listeners, so please feel free to tweet those to me anytime or send us an email to show@sportacos.com with your opinions or your questions, and we'll get to those on the next episode. Thanks again to Tom for coming on to speak to us today. Thanks so much to you for listening, and see you on the next episode of the Sporticos Football Stories podcast.
Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.